So it's my pleasure to introduce a trustee of the Society and a fellow, Pauline Mayer. She's the William K. Kennan Jr. Professor of History at MIT and the author of many books, including American Scripture, Making the Declaration of Independence and Ratification, The People Debate the Constitution, 1787 to 1788. And again, it's my pleasure to welcome Pauline, who will introduce our speaker tonight.
Thank you, Dennis. Ray Raphael has done what nobody is supposed to be able to do and that very few people have accomplished. He is a terrific writer who made it into the ranks of professional historians, the sort that teach at universities without a PhD. Maybe that's the clue to his clear writing. It took me, I think, 30 years to undo what I learned in graduate school. He did that in what I suspect is the only way it could possibly be done, that is by founding his writing on serious research. I met Ray, and I invite you to hear that verb with quotation marks on either side, because the conversations were entirely digital. About 8 years ago, after his book, The American Revolution Before Lexington and Concord, had been published, my somewhat embarrassing memory is that he sent me a copy of the book at my MIT office, and that I promptly put it on a shelf and went off to class and without ever going back to give it a serious look. But Ray didn't just go away after being ignored. He emailed me and told me that the people in Worcester had called for independence in October 1774. I was very doubtful. And this whole exchange was so interesting that I actually downloaded it and never thought it would be useful as it is today. This is what I said. I dunno, D-U-N-N-O, about the country being so wild for independence, much less about Massachusetts overthrowing British rule in 1774. The votes of the Provincial Congress after Lexington and Concord were hardly for independence. They were still trying to find ways to patch things up. There were lots of towns pledging their lives and fortunes for independence in the spring of 1776, but they almost all insisted they were sad about doing that and did it only because they would otherwise be destroyed. That's not just Boston. I cannot at this point think of one Massachusetts town that was so happy as with independence, that is, as, say, the Cheras district in South Carolina. But I'd love to see evidence that I'm wrong. So Ray sent me a second copy of his book, which I which I have here. And it came with little post-it notes, and I think that was to make sure I didn't just stick it on the wall again. It says flags for your convenience, but we know what his real agenda was. It says, and they're very disarming little notes. This one says, ignore chapter one and most of chapter two, embarrassingly simplistic background. Then he said, are you familiar with APS, obviously the American Philosophical Society? And I'm sure I said, duh, I used to be on the board. Then he had pages I should read with little stars on the really important parts and saying, you know, you could skip the rest, but read these pages. I mean, he had a sense that I wasn't going to sit down and read the book. Hey, it was the middle of the term. And as you'll see, he was a teacher. In any case, then there was a place that says Worcester, something else with a little star with a circle around it. And it included a vote of the citizens of Worcester on October 4, 1774, and I would like to read it to you. If all infractions of our rights by acts of the British Parliament, these were instructions I should say to Timothy Bigelow, who was, I believe, their representative in the General Court. If all infractions of our rights by acts of the British Parliament be not redressed, and we restored to the full enjoyment of all our privileges contained in the charter of this province issued by their late Majesties King William and Mary and Queen Mary to a punctillo, before the day of your meeting, which he notes was the very next day, October 5th, then, in that case, you are to consider the people of this province absolved on their part from the obligation therein contained, and to all intents and purposes reduced to a state of nature. You are to exert yourself in devising ways and means to raise from the dissolution of the old constitution, as from the ashes of Phoenix, a new form, wherein all officers shall be dependent on the suffrages of the people for their existence. As such, whatever unfavorable constructions our enemies may put upon such procedure, the exigency of our public affairs leaves us no other alternative from a state of anarchy or slavery. Well, I guess he was right. He had the goods. Not just on independence, and some 21 months, as he notes, before Thomas Jefferson had before the Continental Congress signed Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, or, to be consistent with my own scholarship, the Declaration of Independence that Jefferson had drafted. But also, that the document also included a demand that a republic be built on the ashes of the old regime. And maybe that's even more remarkable because it came over a year before Paine's Common Sense saw print. Indeed, before Thomas Paine had arrived in America. We knew that royal government had to a considerable extent dissolved in rural Massachusetts in the wake of the Massachusetts Government Act, but nobody had told that story so carefully, based on such a scrupulous scrutiny of the documentary record as Ray did in this book. He showed how right Lord Dartmouth was when he wondered in January 1775 how Governor Thomas Gage could have lost authority, quote, to a tumultuous rabble, without any appearance of general concern, or without any head to advise or leader to conduct. British soldiers started the war at Lexington, Concord in April 1775, Ray argued, but the revolution, that is, the military and political transfer of power, had already occurred by then. Moreover, and this may be the most interesting of all, the people of Massachusetts needed no one to tell them what to do. They could and did figure it out themselves. Ray makes that point again very powerfully in an essay on Timothy Bigelow that he contributed to the book Revolutionary Founders, Rebels, Radicals, and Reformers in Making the Nation, which was published in 2011, and that he edited with Gary Nash and Al Young. It is, in my view, one of the two best essays in the book, most of which were written by PhD-holding academics. Ray Raphael, to go back to basics, is a native New Yorker who graduated from Reed College in 1965, spent a year getting a master's at Berkeley, and then went back to Reed to collect a Master of Arts in Teaching the next year. An active participant in the civil rights movement of the 1960s, he became a teacher at pretty much all levels of schooling, elementary, high school, and college. He seems to have moved around a fair amount until he and his wife Marie, a talented writer and photographer, settled down in Northwest California, where he taught at a one-room high school along with evening courses at the local community college. He also started writing, and he hasn't stopped. Since retiring from full-time classroom teaching in 1997, Ray has produced a steady flow of books: A People's History of the American Revolution, How Common People Shaped the Fight for Independence, 2001, The First American Revolution, 2002, with which I began, Founding Myths, Stories That Hide Our Patriotic Past, 2004, Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation, 2009, and The Complete Idiots, Guide to the Founding Fathers and the Birth of Our Nation, 2011. Now that's a title I think no historian who needs to file an annual report with a dean could use. Although it is, Woody Holton testifies, a thorough and sophisticated synthesis of all the cutting-edge scholarship on the American Revolution. I know he has another book in the works on constitutional myths. Tonight, however, he will share with us some insights on the Electoral College, a term that, incidentally, does not appear in either the Constitution or the 12th Amendment. And it will be drawn, I am told, from his latest book, Mr. President, How and Why the Founders Created a Chief Executive. With great pleasure, let me introduce my friend and colleague in the historical profession, Ray Raphael.
Well, that's a heck of an introduction. Hard act to follow. Well, I'm pleased that you all came. I got my PhD. I received my PhD basically right here in the Mass Historical Society Library and in the American Antiquarian Society Library and in the inner depths of the Worcester, the basement of the Worcester City Hall where the town records are kept. In other words, in the documents themselves. And the amazing thing is such a pleasure to talk at AAS or MHS because this is where it happens. I mean, you know, without institutions like this, you can't have somebody just, you know, come in and get all these documents and just go to them. And so I actually regard, libraries such as this very easy to access, very generous with their information, as extremely democratic institutions. And I'm just, you know, and that's just fantastic. So thank you, Pauline. And now it's going to take me a little bit to, you know, that was kind of like going to a reunion or something, you know, because that was sort of my title story, my kind of like title song, you know, my whatever, because that was my really kind of research breakthrough. And since then, I've been doing other things. But we're really not talking about that now. We are talking about the electoral system in the United States. So I want to welcome all you fans of the Electoral College, fans and perhaps not so fans. And we are now engaged in in sort of this, what's the word for every 4 years? Is it a quadrillennial or what is there? What? Quadrennial. Okay, whatever. Yeah. Anyway, this ritual, every 4 years, we start paying attention to the Electoral College right around now, and we all sort of start moaning about it and sort of debating about it in little ways, and will we ever get rid of it, and so on. But how do we get there? How did this thing come to be? And that's the story I'm going to tell you today. It's basically kind of a creation story for this very bizarre institution that we have, and I will argue later on that we are likely to always have in our electoral system. So let's just set the time frame here. The Electoral College, first of all, Pauline is totally right. It's not the Electoral College. We use that term today. That didn't come in until, I can't exactly pin it down, but I think it was around the Jacksonian time. If anybody knows better, bring it up when we have the response. But certainly nowhere in the founding era did anybody use that term. But the creation of the electoral system, the presidential electors, really took place between June 2nd, 1787, and September 8th, 1787, at the Federal Convention. The Federal Convention, of course, is what they called it at the time, so I will call it that too. And now, note those dates, because June 2nd, that is only about 4 days, that's 4 days into the debates, and September 8th, is only 9 days from the very end of the convention. And that's and those dates are going to be significant. So we're going to start the story actually one day at the very beginning of the convention. The Virginia Plan, Randolph introduces the Virginia Plan, and it says it calls for an executive. And now this is why what this is so new is because, of course, there had been no separate executive under the Articles of Confederation. All executive functions were taken care of by Congress. Congress did allocate them at some times, starting in 1781, to department heads, but they still resided within Congress. So naturally, when they said there's an executive, who would appoint the executive? Who would select? Because that's what we're talking about. How do you choose the president? So there was really no question. Of course, Congress chooses the president. There was a, that wasn't an issue. They said that was part of the plan. Congress chooses the president. And so James Wilson asked, you know, we have to narrow this down. What does this really mean? Because they don't say anything other than Congress chooses the president for a period of blank years and not to be re-eligible for election, and something about the recompense. So James Wilson stands up and he says, okay, I move for a single executive. And if you don't trust me that he said that, step right over here and break. And right over there on the left-hand page, about two or three paragraphs down, try to find the word single executive in James Wilson. Peek through there. It's fun. So he also... that, by the way, brings the convention to an absolute dead silence. Single executive? And that's a whole, wow, are we going to do this? Is that like a king? What's going to happen? And so it's the only time in the convention that everybody just is quiet. Eventually they start talking and they start saying, well, what are we going to do about this? Is Congress going to elect him or what? And Wilson actually then makes another motion. He says, I move the people... elect the executive. And by that time, they don't know whether it's single or plural. And he does not get a favorable response. They have a brief discussion, and then he gets he only gets his own delegation and one other in Pennsylvania. And so we're left with Congress selecting the president. They move on to other related issues, such as how to fill in that blank year, should he really be ineligible, he or she or they be ineligible. And by June 4th, they actually have outlined the executive office. There will be one executive, single executive, no name yet for that position. Single executive elected for one 7-year term, and not re-eligible by Congress, and removable from office for malpractice or neglect of duty. Okay, so that's it. Now, if you look at that, Congress chooses the president, and then the president. Well, I'm going to call him the president. You know, the term that's going to come up on August 6th. I'm just going to use that because it's easier. Congress elects the president, chooses the president, and then Congress can also get rid of the president at any point for malpractice or neglect of duty. Is that the way our Constitution reads now? It's a little more precise, you know, just malpractice or neglect of duty. That's so general, Congress can really pretty much remove. So basically, is there an independent executive? Functionally, not. And people like James Wilson and Gouverneur Morris and some others are very upset about this. They say, no, we want an executive. We want an independent executive. So they start going off on all the other topics. They're actually going down point by point on the Virginia plan, and they just table the whole presidential discussion for a while, the executive discussion. But in mid-July, they bring it up again, and once again, Wilson and his partner in this, Gouverneur Morris, moved to have an election by the people, popular election, to which George Mason responds. Selecting the president by the people would be like, let me get the exact quote here. Well, anyway, it's like a, oh, trial of colors, like giving the trial of colors to a blind man. So that's, you know, if you leave it to the people, it's the trial of colors to a blind man. And that's pretty much the way most of the convention feels, certainly the way they vote. So they won't go, it's like popular election is kind of off the table. It's been brought up twice and thoroughly rejected. But Gouverneur Morris in particular says, hey, let's not call it quits. And Wilson actually, also, Wilson, now, I'm going to backtrack actually, I forgot this, on June 2nd, James Wilson actually said, okay, if you don't want the popular election, here is an alternative. Okay, and this is the very beginning. See if this rings the bell at all. Mr. Wilson made the following motion to be substituted for the mode proposed by Mr. Randolph's resolution. That's the Virginia plan. That the executive magistracy shall be elected in the following manner, that the states be divided into districts, and that the persons qualified to vote in each district for members of the first branch of the national legislature elect members for the respective districts to be electors of the executive magistracy. That said electors of the executive magistracy meet at blank, and they or any blank of them so met shall proceed to elect by ballot, but not out of their own body, blank person, they haven't figured single or plural, in whom the executive authority of the national government shall be vested. In other words, just a broad outline of an electoral system. And that doesn't get any farther than the popular vote. So now I'm going to go back forward to the to mid-July when they're reconsidering this. And once the popular vote has been voted down once again, they raise this issue. And Gouverneur Morris has a very interesting speech that day because all these other issues about how long the president serves and whether he can be reelected, impeached, and so on, he says, you know, these are all related. They're really all one issue. Because we're talking about dependence or independence of the executive. Now, on the one hand, you can have Congress selecting the president, but if Congress selects the president, clearly the president cannot be reelected, or he would by Congress, or he would always have to do the bidding of Congress at the risk of being not elected anymore. So you have to, that goes along. If Congress selects, it has to be one term. If it's one term, it better be kind of a reasonably long term, so you get 7 years, right? But you can't, if it's 7 years, well, they can't just let them go and do anything he wants for 7 years, so it has to be this broad impeachment. But if you have the broad impeachment procedure, then you're back to dependency again. And you say, that's one rubric. But how about another one? Because he really didn't like this idea of impeachment. He was against all impeachment. He says, if Congress can remove the president, there's no such thing as independence. This is Gouverneur Morris. And so he says, how about this? How about the Congress is elected by the people every 2 years? And then you don't need impeachment, because the people are the body that impeaches, right? And so you have a frequent elections. Clearly, if he can be elected every 2 years, it has to be repeatable. You see, so you have a whole other rubric, popular election, frequent popular elections, and a repeatable presidency, no need for impeachment. So that's way too radical for them to handle. But he says, you know, let's reconsider everything. And, you know, even as radical as the idea is, they say, okay, we'll reconsider absolutely everything. And they do. A very persuasive speech. It's interesting because Gouverneur Morris, because he's all over the map, by the way, 2 days earlier he was speaking in favor of life term for the president. the way he operated is he played the moment. It's not like he just had one position. He said, this is where we're going. We can actually do something here. So he suggested that. And they actually reconsidered everything, and they moved to repeatable terms and selection by electors who were appointed by the state legislatures. But they didn't go all the way to 2 years, but they lessened it from 7 years to six. And that's the way it remained for the next 4 days. And then the backtracking began. And interestingly enough, the backtracking began when they tried to figure out which state got how many electors. that little argument basically started the whole system downhill. And so, 4 days later, they retracted it. And they went back to the original. So now we're up to the end of July, when the convention recesses, and they say, you know, we have to flesh this thing out. They had made a bunch of resolutions, but there wasn't really a body there. It was just a bunch of resolutions. So they appoint a committee of detail, 5-person committee of detail, and the committee of detail comes back with a report. And part of that report you can see actually right here on August 6th. That's the Elder Scary's version of the Committee of Detail report, annotated version, right here. But that didn't change anything. So it's still we still have that basic rubric of Congress electing the president. Okay, now Morris is not going to sit on his hands. He's really the active one here. And he starts trying to move some powers over to the presidency that had been with the Senate. For instance, treaty-making powers with the Senate, appointive powers with the Senate. So this president, elected by Congress, really, and removable by Congress, didn't have many powers. But he could, and he's pushing for those, but he doesn't get it. And so they try one more time on August 24th. Popular election? No. Third time, soundly defeated. Okay. One reason it keeps going down is because the dominant paradigm there really was a philosophy that Madison called successive filtrations. They needed to ground the Constitution in the people. That absolutely had to be. Popular sovereignty is the cornerstone of it all. But they didn't want the people to actually rule on a sort of daily basis. They had to have successive filtrations. So people would elect on the one body had to be directly elected, the House of Representatives, the lower house. You needed that much. But everything after that, they wanted some remove. That was the generally accepted idea. And the idea of having electors, at least put it at one remove. So when the popular vote goes down once more, again only two votes voting for it, Gouverneur Morris says, "Okay, how about electors who are selected by the people?" And he actually gets by now a closer vote, and it goes down only 6-5. So he says, "Hey, I'm in within range here." Now we're up to August 24th. They've been meeting June, July for almost 3 months. And he's getting a little somewhere, but he still got defeated because the motion electors by the state legislatures. Okay, so he says, how about this? How about who? It's sort of a who wants now the kind of motion. Okay, guys, who wants? This is sort of the formality of it. Who wants electors? Just as an abstract question. Abstract question. Let's not be formal. The abstract question. It's a funny thing because I don't recall any other vote in the Constitutional Convention coming on an abstract question of electors. It's kind of like a straw poll. And now he actually gets a tie vote, 4-4. Okay, so well, that's close. But 4-4 by the rules of the convention is decided as they say in the negative. In the negative, not good enough. Why only four? Like there's two divided, and people aren't voting. It's nobody's taking that vote very seriously. Massachusetts is so confused. Incidentally, they just we don't know what to do with this. So nobody's taking that vote seriously. Okay, so now we have they've actually decided at this point that there was the congressional seven non-repeatable. 7 years non-repeatable, and they've also decided right at that moment that they will have how Congress is going to vote. Congress is going to vote because do they vote each branch independently, and then they both have to approve, or is it a joint ballot? So that raises a huge discussion having to do with small state, large state, and will the Senate. Senators be outnumbered by the representatives and so on, but they actually decide to go for a joint ballot, okay, and which disappoints the small states. So the small states now become Gouverneur Morris's ally in this, okay, but they've actually decided it's joint ballot, and you need a majority, absolute majority. A plurality will not work, and in case of a tie, the Senate. Elects the makes cast the final. I mean, the president of the Senate cast the final vote. So in other words, it's a done deal. They've done it. Okay, as of August 24th. So then on August 31st, this is kind of a little. This is our moment of intrigue here. Okay, on August 31st, they are actually talking of the very fine points here. They're saying, okay, on the very first election, how does the president get elected? Like, how are we going to do that? What kind of system are we going to have on what date and all that sort of thing? And Gouverneur Morris says, wait, that hasn't been decided. They've just appointed what they call the Committee of 11. You might know it as the Committee of Remaining Matters, that's a common name for it, or Postponed Matters, Remaining Matters. In other words, a few loose ends. This was not a loose end. It had been decided. But he says it hasn't been decided. And when you think of it, what hasn't been decided about? They've decided about it. And what he's referring to is that straw poll was 4-4, which had actually been decided because that's a negative. So he has no legal thing to stand on. But meanwhile, the New Jersey folks, Jonathan Dayton and Brearley, they don't like this either. And when they were moving on to this question of finalize the length of term and whether it's repeatable, they said, don't vote today. Please hold off and vote tomorrow. Now we're back to August 24th. Just vote tomorrow. And then tomorrow, people say, why? They said, we're just not ready. And so tomorrow never comes. They never raise it again. No one ever raises again. So on August 31st, there are these two other remaining matters that haven't technically been confirmed, which is the length of term and the re-eligibility. Because New Jersey is kind of like by subterfuge, you know, sort of like just put them off to put them on committee, okay? So Morris, since these things had sort of been grouped, Morris just like kind of by association gets this other thing on the committee. Well, guess who's on the committee? Yeah. Brearley is actually from New Jersey, the head of the committee. And as it turns out, the other members of the committee happen to be people, most of them had actually voted or spoken in favor of an elector system. So it goes to committee, having already been decided, you know, and gets reported out as a few changes in our, you know, in our system here. They were only supposed to do a few details. Well, one of the details is, okay, the executive, which is now the president, by the way, the Committee of Detail Report, which is there, was actually, that's when they used the word president. The president suddenly gets the powers of treaty making and appointment with the advice and consent of the Senate, but he has those two powers. Those have been with the Senate all along. So this is not just little details. These are big things. And suddenly, Congress doesn't select the president. And what happens, and nor does the president 7 years and non-repeatable, suddenly he's 4 years and repeatable. They've overthrown the entire sense of the convention, this committee, the Committee of 11. And they devised this elaborate scheme. Well, actually, let me just give you what they were working with when they had to devise this scheme. Nobody really liked congressional selection. They understand Morris and Wilson had a ironclad point. How do you have independence when you're dependent? I mean, it's hard to argue against that. So you would think they would go for popular, but they just couldn't go for popular. That just wasn't, they weren't ready for that. They didn't want to do it. People now sometimes argue, oh, they didn't have the system, the infrastructure for it, but that's not a sound argument, because they could have had elections the same way that they did for, they could have just had the states administer those elections and then just allocate the number, the weighting of the votes according the same way they wound up doing it for electoral college. So it was feasible to do it. You didn't have to have a federal machinery to conduct your elections. That could have been done on a local level. But anyway, they had to figure out how shall we involve the people or not. That was the first, you know, they had to figure that out. They had to figure out like how to weight the votes. If you have electoral votes by the states, how do you weight it? And basically, so this is what they have to do here, the committee is doing, is they're rehashing the whole small state, large state, and slave issues, right? You know, slave apportionment, you know, which, you know, the three-fifths and all that. They have to work that out in committee, how to do that. And then they have to figure out, what about a runoff? Because if you have electors from the states, very likely there'll be a lot of favorite sons, and probably it could be the favorite son from the largest state is going to just get in. because they'd have the most votes. So they have to deal with all this stuff. And they deal with it in a series of complex negotiations, backdoor negotiations, which Madison refers to obliquely in a footnote as the compromises within the committee, and then there are other references to these compromises. We don't have that committee record. But they even brought in this obscure thing to the compromises about whether the Senate could initiate a money bill. You know, that's part of the great compromise, and it had been in the compromise, and then it would have gotten removed, and they reintroduced it. And this all has to do with small state, large state power. So what they report out of the committee, we don't need to get into all the details of who or what, but what I'm saying is it's a complex political situation. Okay, and so the report that comes out of the committee is basically the electoral system, which is you vote for two people. Why two people? Well, two people, because that was to try to get rid of the favorite son. Because if you only vote for one, everybody votes for somebody of their own state, and you're kind of in that whole weird... One of whom cannot be from your own state. Okay, so now... Okay, we've solved the local problem, they say. Okay, good enough. Okay, but what does it mean to vote for two people? Who are you really... You can't vote for two presidents if there's not two presidents, right? So, I know. You vote for a president and a vice president. And such it was, and that was the invention of the vice president, was to be the second person for whom you vote for in the electoral system. Okay, so you had to have somebody to vote for. Well, what does that person do? Well, I don't know. I guess he's vice president means he must be, maybe if the president dies, he'll be president, because before it would have been obviously, there was no need for succession before that, because Congress selected the president. If he died, they just select another one. You know, in the interim, it would probably be the president of the Senate, you know, just for, but it, suddenly there was an issue of, because they can't have these elections all the time. You have to, okay, so they do that. Anything else to do? Well, I don't know. Well, let's make him president of the Senate. Something to do, you know. Kind of strange, because like this is supposed to be about the executive, and suddenly he's in the legislative department, and he casts a tie-breaking vote. I don't know. Well, anyway, so that's what happened. So actually, when Dick Cheney said, "No, I'm not in the executive department. I'm in the legislative department." Remember that when he was trying to get out of the executive print, everybody laughed at him. Nah, he was telling the truth. actually, that was the only formal thing he had to do. Pauline can tell you some people afterwards had a few words to say about this, these kind of arrangements, these sort of sloppy arrangements and the intermingling of the branches and so on. So anyway, the key thing though, then they have to argue, all about the allocation they got, and they settle that by saying, okay, well, it'll be just like the joint ballot of Congress, namely however many people are in both the House and the Senate, that's how many votes you have, electoral votes. So it, functionally, it's worked the same way as a joint ballot, okay? But they also have to settle the matter of what happens if you don't have a majority, okay? Well, you can't. What do you do? The small states very much didn't want to have a plurality worked, because once again, you'd only have large state probably presidents. So you have to have another system. So they said, okay, we'll have a runoff, and the runoff will have the five top candidates, not the two, but the five top candidates selected by the Senate. You know, why five candidates? I mean, that's so many. And they say, well, these people will all have been vetted because they've gotten a few votes. And basically what's happened then is you're throwing it back into Congress again. So you kind of like, it's a huge like retreat. And they give it to the Senate, which is already the most, that successive filtration is the most filtered body. So you have, and the other thing they do is they decide that no, it's not the people who vote for the electors. It's actually the state legislatures decide on their own how the electors are going to be selected. So they can give it to the people or they can keep it for themselves, right? So basically, they still have the power. So it's a kind of this giant retreat, okay? what happens is this gets, this whole elaborate scheme gets reported out, and it's dumped. You know how they talk about a news dump? You know, on Friday, the Friday news dump? These guys are tired. Now it's, by now it's September 4th. They've been meeting over 3 months. They're totally fatigued. They thought these, this committee was supposed to just, like, you know, tighten up a few loose ends, right? And they could go home soon. And suddenly this entire new system is dumped on them. Okay, so Edmund Randolph and Charles Pinckney, quote, wished for a particular explanation and discussion of the reasons for changing the mode of electing the executive. Yes, I think maybe we should. What are you talking about? You know, they want to know what do you guys, why did you do this? So Gouverneur Morris basically responds with, let me just find this, with basically the biggest argument for an independent executive. And 1 second here. And he says, and this was all along, it's been the major argument. The major argument has been that Congress, they knew Congress would be political. They knew there'd be parties within it, and they knew that the House and the Senate were very differently composed, and one was conceived as the Democratic branch, and the other was conceived as the aristocratic branch. Hamilton actually said one was to represent the masses of the people, the other the rich and the well-born. And the president was supposed, the idea of why they wanted an independent executive was supposed to, quote, stand the mediator. Stand the mediator, that's the term from Wilson, okay? And because there would be too much intrigue otherwise, okay? So that's pretty much what Morris responds when he says he's going to give the reasons of the committee and his own. The first was the danger of intrigue and faction. As the electors would vote at the same time throughout the U.S., because that was part of the deal, they'd all get together, and they'd all get together in their own states. They'd never come together, okay? And at so great a distance from each other, the great evil of cabal was avoided, okay? And Hamilton in the Federalist Papers, in the Federalist, Federalist Essay number 68, by the way, Federalist Papers didn't get called the Federalist Papers until the 19, quite recently. Anyway, that's my next book, Constitutional Myths. It's a long story. But anyway, it really kicked in with the New American Library version in 1961. That's when the Federalist Papers kind of kicked over. But anyway, in Federalist 68, nothing was more to be desired than that every practical obstacle should be opposed to cabal, intrigue, and corruption. The convention have guarded against all dangers of this sort with the most provident and judicious attention. Okay? So in other words, they thought, the argument was, we have solved the whole problem. Congress was going to get together and connive to get the president, the factions. But these guys are voted upon separately, distant from each other, and won't have a chance to talk to each other before that one day and in a distant place, okay? And so there won't be any cabal. We've got it. Eureka, okay? Now, one might think that a few questions could be asked about whether that was really the way it was going to work. They were too tired. Not one question was asked about that. They had a debate. The only issue with this entire thing, this package, was whether the runoff should be in the House or the Senate. And they went on and on about that, and the small states didn't want it sent over to the House, where they weren't as powerful. But other people said the Senate is the last body that you should do it with, and they finally came up with the obvious solution. Put it in the House with the vote by delegation, state delegation. So it's still one state, one vote of the House members, so they're still directly. And that's the way it is. That's the way that it is in the Constitution. Okay. So they went on and on about that, and nobody challenged. Now, imagine yourself there. You might want to say something like, well, do we really think that it's impossible to have intrigue at a distance? Does the fact that people are far away avoid intrigue? How about the fact that these people are serving? The other thing that Hamilton and Morris and the other apologists for the system said was they're only serving for a moment, so they have nothing to gain. The electors, you know, they have nothing to gain for this. Is that true if you only serve for a moment, that somehow immunizes you against political influence? Well, these are reasonable questions to ask, right? But what was happening is they were operating on this kind of, first of all, they were totally tired, and they were frustrated because they hadn't really got a solution yet. And, you know, they didn't want the popular, they didn't want the Congress, and, okay, here's some. So they didn't really want to ask the hard questions. And their view of intrigue and cabal, I think, was kind of colored. This is my feeling, was colored by this idea that intrigue is what happens in the cold corridors of European courts with whispers and promises of position. So if people are in their separate states, you know, just voting, they'll just be vote as free spirits, right? They'll be totally free. So anyway, but it passes. It passes, and on September 8th it passes, and that is the Electoral College. Okay, how's it going to be received? Okay, well, Pauline knows a thing or two about how things were received, and it was not the major compelling issue that really perhaps determined votes, but there were some, out of doors, there were some critics of this kind of, this plan. One criticism was that they were, people said they were actually, the president would be at a fourth or fifth hand removed. When you think that the people, let's say of state legislatures, the state legislature kept the vote for electors to themselves. So the people would vote for the state legislature. The state legislature would vote for the elector, right? And then the elector would vote for the president, but then if there wasn't a majority, then the elector, then that went to the House, which was another set of removed. You know, here's an interesting quote from an opposition argument. Oh, okay, Republicus from Kentucky commented wryly, an extraordinary refinement this on the plain simple business of election, and of which the Grand Convention have certainly the honor of being the first inventors. So anyway, quote was worth the wait. and it really was, when you think of that first inventors, because these guys... Everything else they have, they're like justifying from historical allusions and, you know, classical history and these grand, you know, philosophical arguments to make their point. And there's no such thing. There's no argument made in favor of it, other than it's going to solve intrigue somehow. And there's no historical examples. They literally just conjured this thing as this kind of stopgap. Bring it together, get enough votes, move on. It's not Congress. It's not the people. Whatever it is, it'll have to do. And it basically, when Madison is forced with defending this thing during the ratification debates, he basically says as much. He says, "I know it's not perfect, but okay, I challenge you. You know, you got anything better? You know, do you have anything better? And if you don't want popular election, you're going to be somewhat hard pressed to come up with something really better." Justification of it. They're trying to sell it to the people. Now, do you remember what it said? Who votes for the electors? Is it the people? No. It's the state legislators determine who votes for the list. But now, Alexander Hamilton, in his Federalist Essays, in Federalists, numbers, there's in four separate Federalist Essays, he just insinuates that the people are kind of he says that the ultimate choice is really with the people, and then he actually states that they are elected by the people. And Hamilton was at the convention. You know, he was on the committee of style at the very end with a fine tuning of it. And this is something very critical, you know, the relationship with the people. And he actually says He actually says that electors are chosen for that purpose by the people. He says that point blank, and he repeats that idea. Sometimes it's a little bit more diffuse, but in four separate essays, right? So, in other words, he's trying to sell this thing as kind of a popular document, but it really shows no... But he wants it. He obviously wants it because of that same argument about how it's supposedly going to solve intrigue. Okay, so now I ask you, did it solve intrigue? Okay, so now we're going to return to Alexander Hamilton because it does pass. I mean, it's not a major issue in ratification. And so now we are voting for the first president. Okay, everybody, of course, wants Washington. Who's going to be vice president? Well, people start getting together. Who do we want as vice president? Is this all the people everywhere just popular? No. Who do you want? Who do you want? Who do you want? Okay, so they start, and then Washington kind of gives his okay with John Adams. A little regional balance, that was very significant. They knew they wanted a northerner. They had to have a northerner. So they settle on Adams. But suddenly, Hamilton is worried. Remember that thing where you vote for two people at once? What if everybody votes for the Hamilton-Adams ticket, but some screwy elector somewhere, just a couple of them, say, I didn't like what Washington did. He never commissioned my kid for, whatever. And so let's just not do it. And then suddenly Adams is president. And suddenly Hamilton said, now 10 days before the electors are to meet, 10 days before they're to meet, he starts sending letters around. Everyone knows the obvious defect of the Constitution that you vote for two people and you don't determine which, right? After, praising it or whatever. Everyone knows the obvious defect. So here's what I want you to do. We have to decide, we, the Federalists, the in crowd, have to throw away 7 or 8 votes for Adams. Don't vote the party ticket, okay? So that won't happen. He actually uses the word 7 or 8. And he's sending this around to people in 6 of the 11 states that are voting. Okay, now, is this intrigue? And he's doing this because there's actually a lot of time between the vote for the electors and when the electors meet. Certainly one could see that they'd be susceptible to pressures during that time, right? They never thought of that at the convention. Certainly they can see that you can write a letter to somebody in another state just as well as you can whisper in the corridors of a court, right? And these things, it hasn't immunized anything. It's every bit as political, and as we will see, it actually heightens the politicalization of the whole thing. So anyway, so he does that, and as it turns out, he didn't have to because not everybody voted for Adams anyway. So, of course, the first two elections are not really contested. Other than that, he was the only one to even think of anything like that. But then we get to the election of 1796. Okay, and in 1796, what's happened is people have talked about this at Old South. The powers of the presidency and now have become so obvious that you cannot possibly get a program that you would like without capturing it. It's not like he can do everything, but you can't do anything without him. And so you really need it. And that need is actually stimulating the development of political parties on a national scale, which, of course, was what both the presidency was supposed to avoid, right? It was supposed to be the mediator. And this whole argument about how political parties will be harder to develop on a national, factions on a national scale than on local scales, and somehow they'll offset each other, kind of is turned on its head. And it actually stimulates the development of these. So people actually nominate the candidates. There's Jefferson, and people start saying, well, if Jefferson comes, we will fritter away the Constitution. We'll fritter away and innovate upon the Constitution. That's what the opponents say. He will fritter away and innovate upon the Constitution. And of course, if Adams gets elected, that's just the big, huge step towards monarchy, because we all know that Adams was a monarchist. This is on the other side, right? So you have this kind of like negative campaigning, and all this is going on. And yeah, we don't know about that, but it's it kind of has an early genesis, and it's triggered to this whole idea of how to select the president. So Hamilton gets busy again because he is worried, it's a very close election, and he is worried that Adams, the Federalist, is not going to get enough votes because he won't get a single vote in the South. So they say, we need a Southern candidate. How about Thomas Pinckney? Because he's had some diplomatic success, and he's from South Carolina. And he'll probably get some South Carolina votes, and that would just... So Adams starts saying, look, if we all vote for Pinckney, even if Adams won't get a couple of votes in the South, Pinckney will, and we'll have Pinckney, and that's the way we will keep Jefferson out of office, right? So he starts sending out his letters again. And there's a whole move, and he starts saying... And now remember he was worried that the people would throw away their votes? Now he's writing to all the Federalists in the North saying, don't throw away any votes, because if you throw away votes, then Jefferson might be vice president. You know, so you have to vote for Adams and Pinckney. All right, so now he just reversed his strategy, but it's based on the same thing. And then he was hoping that would happen. And as one of his confidants said, if Pinckney gets in, he's going to owe us, and we can control him. But if Adams gets in, he would have gotten in anyway. He doesn't owe us anything. So you have within, this is sort of the, you're getting this real split in the politics of the Federalism, the kind of what turns out to be the hard Federalism. That's a whole other story into Adams' administration. But you see the politicalization of it, and that's really what I'm getting at, the politicalization of this. And at this point, it's based, that politicalization is kind of based on this kind of, this little kink in the system about the two votes. And of course, you probably all know how that comes into play in the election of 1800, which is kind of a repeat of the election of 1796, which is because people were so scared of, Jefferson only received, I think it was four fewer votes than Adams in the previous election. But that boosted him above Pinckney, so he was vice president, so he had the split ticket, right? So in the next election, everybody was petrified of having the split ticket. So suddenly, everybody is voting the party ticket, right? But everybody is voting the party ticket, except one person who is smart enough on the Federalist side to distinguish, but they only made it one. So, of course, Burr and Jefferson tie. And then that goes into the runoff and the 36th ballot, and you have all the Federalists suddenly voting for Aaron Burr, who none of them liked, and yet things are getting so unbelievably weird. But this the extent of how deep this the politicalization, they can and did solve the vote for two people problem with the 12th Amendment, right? But here's what they didn't solve. They didn't solve the idea that electors, the whole point about electors is we are voting for people who are the best, wisest people who will select our wisest person. And they actually use the words like free, unfettered decision. And by 1800, every elector had no discretion at all. They were pre-committed, as they are today, to vote for who they were supposed to vote for. And they were just, the entire notion of this filtration was totally removed. So the system wasn't just a little bit, needed a little oil, with the 12th Amendment. The system just totally backfired. It just went against itself. And this is really perhaps my favorite assessment of that, which comes from Noah Webster. Okay, Noah Webster. He was a very influential Federalist, a very good writer, as we know, had a sort of a way with words, you might say. In a pamphlet penned during the ratification debates, he writes, "The President of the United States is elective. And what is a capital improvement on the best governments? The mode of choosing him excludes the danger of faction and corruption." Right? That's what he wrote then. So in 1800, He has a personal copy of his own pamphlet, right? And in 1800, he jots down in the margins, "This proves how little dependence can be placed on theory. 12 years' experience or 4 elections demonstrates the contrary." So anyway, that kind of says it all. In a kind of a more sweeping sense that we might want to get into, I kind of draw two sort of moral, way grander morals from this story. One is, it's kind of like the Oedipal story, which you, in trying to escape your fate, you create it. Because that's what they were trying. They really wanted to escape this kind of politicalization at the highest end of the executive office. And somehow by doing that, they devised this system, which is not solely responsible for it. But rather than merely reflect the partisanship, it actually augmented it and triggered it. It was like a catalyst to hasten it. Okay, that's one level. And the other level is when you think of it and how we still have it today, 200 and whatever years later, and how we feel kind of saddled with it every time we get to this time in our election cycle and people remember, oh yeah, what about that? And the notion that, and by the way, we can talk about this, my own sense is that we are it is not going to be changed by a constitutional amendment. Because when you look at it today, you need 3/4 of the states to approve a constitutional amendment. And when you put battleground states, which certainly have a vested interest in keeping it, early primary states, small states, you have a lot of states with very clear vested interests, let alone the extreme partisanship. If any party thinks they might gain an advantage by eliminating it, you can be darn sure the other party is going to oppose it, and there's no party is going to command 3/4 of the states in the near future. So I think we're kind of stuck with it. And that leads to what I would consider the second grand message, which isn't it amazing how humans can be stuck with their own contrivances for centuries, just saddled with things that had happened long ago. And, it's for better and worse. Obviously, the Constitution had a lot of functional things, but there's these aspects of it that are just, they're just there. And all we can do is deal with it, right? And anyway, hopefully there's some food for thought in all of this, and let me encourage the discussions can be both historical and also perhaps, see how this might or might not relate to the present. Thank you. So, how does this work? Yeah.
This electoral system, which we are, quote, stuck with, mm-hmm. was it ever before used, or was it just the brainchild of that group?
I am not a historian of world history, ancients, and I can't really answer that, in terms of any kind of authoritative way, but I can answer authoritatively this, that whereas so many other features of the Constitution, if there was a precedent, the framers noted it and used that. They did not use the precedent. If there was one, it wasn't a factor in developing this system, I can say that. Does anyone have further, we have a knowledgeable crew, does anyone have further any knowledge of an electoral system similar to this from the past? Yeah.
Didn't Maryland use it for electing the upper house of the legislature?
A separate
kind of an electoral system and the details on it.
Yeah. On a local level, I think on a state level, and it might not have just been Maryland. That might have happened. And once again, that would have been with the idea, particularly for the upper house, of having of filtrations. So there could have been some local influence, but I don't know anything sort of on a grand scale. As I say, I'm not authoritative, but we do know that if there was something that really influenced them, we would have heard about it, and there's no record that they have that. Yeah. Yeah.
When did we get the idea that the people would vote for the president via the electors, and when did we get the idea that each state would be unanimous, which I found very useful because it contained the damage of Florida and so forth to one state.
Yeah.
But you didn't say like 7 electors in Massachusetts were for Bush and
Yeah.
Gore.
Okay. Yeah. Two questions. The first one is when did the people start voting instead of the state legislature for the electors? And the answer to that is that there's no one date. As a matter of fact, in the early elections, they were split. Some states gave it to the people. Some remember, it's legislatures themselves determine which. Some gave it to them. Some didn't. Okay. Interestingly enough, in the election of 1800. Things had been so politicized that legislatures that had given it to the people, if they were in control, they took it back. They said, no, we're going to have it, okay? And there was three that did that, two on one side, one on the other. And then there was others that said, and this is, speaks to your other problem, we're going to do district elections or not. That was an issue because, if you're the party in control, you don't want a district election. So that was an issue with two other states. Okay, in New York was the most interesting because New York had a Federalist majority in the state legislature. And so New York said, okay, winner take all. Okay, winner take all. Because they're, because they figured that would do. But then in the intervening elections, the Republicans beat the Federalists, and suddenly the Republicans have winner-take-all, and the Federalists say, oh, no, that's not fair. We need district elections. And the Republicans say, oh, no, it's written right there, winner-take-all, right? So Alexander Hamilton, once again, enter Alexander Hamilton, he writes a letter to John Jay saying, you know what, we're still in control right now. Let's rewrite the rule. Right now, because we can do it right now. And John Jay says, oh, you're going over, I can't go that far. I mean, he just pulls back way, way far back. Jay was the governor, because, Hamilton, who was for, winner take all, suddenly says, we are now in control. We can rewrite the rule of the districts. So before we're out of office, that's the level of politicalization that it reached. And then you can still, there's no rule about whether you can split or not, Maine and Nebraska still have some kind of split. So it's still basically the state legislatures still decide, and they decide, whether it's the people or not. But now, of course, any state legislator who would actually say, no, the state legislature decides and the people don't vote, that tendency, really gets ingrained in the system and it's hard to go back. They did go back on it in the early days when they're not as responsible, but now, That's not going to change. Yeah.
Would it be fair to say that the American government is formed on the basis of distrust of the people?
Well, that's a complicated...
Can you just repeat that?
Oh, will it be fair to say whether the American government is formed on a distrust of the people? And this is a huge argument. And there are quotations that you can take. Roger Sherman, the government should have as little to do with the people as possible. Eldridge Geary, excess of democracy. There are those quotations. Other people, like Akhil Amar, will say, no, it's a very democratic institution. We the people, it's all about ratification, had to be by the people. Amendments and a bunch of other internal things, but there's also filtrations. My sense is that in all of these things, is the American government formed on this? There's all kinds of dichotomies like this, by the people or not, and they were treading a very fine line, and they were going on both ends of that line. And so you can extract the things on both ends, and they were trying to strike this kind of little balance in there. That's the same with state and federal power and so on. That there's a balance in all these things they were seeking. In a general way, I think the idea of filtrations was quite widespread. James Wilson was really the only one who really, well, Morris did for his particular reason, but not really great philosophy. But James Wilson actually took the logic of the people to the last level. Oh, a little side note here. A lot of times people say Gouverneur Morris, when he rewrote the preamble, we the people of the United States, and it used to say we the people of North to South, how come they always did North to South? That was customary, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and so on. And he took that out. And they say that shows that it's really we the people, it was his nationalism and the states were supposed to be subservient, And you see that this is something that's often promoted at the high school and maybe undergraduate level. It's like as kind of a rah-rah sort of thing, we the people. In fact, they absolutely had to do that. You can't start a constitution, we the people of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island. What, Rhode Island? I think, what are we going to do with this first draft? You know, because, of course, Rhode Island hadn't ratified. They didn't know if they, you know, so it made no sense. It was kind of a necessity they had to do that. What was that relevant to? Oh, the we the people. Yeah, the we the people. You know, in other words, and like Amar will say that that shows how democratic they were, and I'm just saying there's a whole practical thing on this. Okay, yeah.
Washington was the 600-pound gorilla in the room, wasn't he?
I thought he was a little trimmer than that. I had the portraits, obviously, and that's a whole other point. When you look at the idea of the presidency, and that is a reason in a sense, that's a contributing reason, like why they didn't look further and examine deeper, like whether there could be intrigue, because they had convinced themselves that the president could and therefore would be transcendent, and the presence of Washington, and they felt confident that he would be, you know, and he certainly aspired to be transcendent in terms of transcending partisan politics. That did sort of, they would say, like Franklin would say, you know, he's going to be the first, but don't get misled. You know, we don't know what's going to follow. And Franklin was very suspicious of a lot of this. He was very suspicious of the increasing powers of the presidency. But Washington made it easier to overlook things like that. In fact, Washington really genuinely did come in wanting to be nonpartisan, bipartisan, whatever. Certainly his endorsement of the Bill of Rights, Pauline, the first 10 amendments. Pauline is working on a fascinating project, like when did people first call it the Bill of Rights, and to be continued later, but she's in the middle of some amazing research for that. But his endorsement of that was certainly that move, but through the bickerings that are going on in his administration, by the end, he's calling his opponents in the democratic societies, there are these groups, he's blaming them from everything under the sun. You know, and so he's really kind of, even he couldn't really maintain that transcendent image. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why should the congressional districts, which are federal offices, be determined by state politicians?
Why should congressional districts be determined by state politicians? I'm not...
Is it a distrust of the cabal of the vote in Washington?
Well, that was a big issue about like whether the extent to which federal control or would or would not interfere with the election process. You know, who's got the election process? And three most frequent amendments suggested to the Constitution. What was it, Pauline? There's the taxes and the limitation of the powers, and the other was about federal elections.
1-4. Hmm? Article 1, Section 4.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, it was a contested issue. When you say the word should, it was contested then, and it's another one of these balance things. You know, they didn't want to tread too. The federal government, remember, they had to get it passed, and they didn't want to be too commandeering over the states. And if the federal government was conducting state elections, that could have been the nail in the coffin that would doom the project. So that would be my guess as to. But it was a contested concept. Yes, another hand, yeah. Mm-hmm. You mean like when they actually meet in the Electoral College and all that, or what?
No, I mean that is this not taught that people don't know about it?
I don't know. Do you think it's lost historically? I think people are pretty well tuned in to the idea that it's by state. You know, they know that it's voting by state, and if Florida wins by however many hanging chad votes Florida wins by, you know, that means there's so many electoral votes. I think your point is nobody really has much of a concept of what an electoral vote is, or that it used to be a person who was actually supposed to vote for somebody who he thought was best, you know? And certainly that's lost. Nobody really kind of, because any concept that elector is supposed to exercise individual discretion, you know, I mean, that's lost because it's been lost for over two centuries. I mean, it's not. When you talk about original intent of the Constitution, well, that sure wasn't their original intent. I mean, and as a matter of fact, as I say, it's really the reverse. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, following on what you just said, what about the concept of renegade electors? Are they really thinking about pledging electors originally?
No, they never dreamt of the notion of a pledge. The very essence of why they wanted an elector was to be not pledged. This elector should be free. They were supposed to, you were supposed to elect your most, you know, noble citizen who would just have the good of the nation at heart and therefore transcend anything else. And maybe also the good of the state. That's true too. But the good of the state and the nation, but certainly not anybody's personal well-being. That was the concept, the hope. But as I argued here, it really was a hope. And they were only able to operate on that as a hope in terms of it being an expectation, honestly, because they were tired. I mean, they had done, and this whole thing has sprung upon them on the end, and they just can't deal with it. Nobody's gotten a solution in the first 3.5 months. Here's a solution which seems to approximate something. We'll take it. You know, honestly, because they didn't even question it. Not one question on that concept. Yeah, and then Pauline.
With all this state versus state power, how do they go about deciding how many electors each state gets?
Well, that's in the Constitution. It's you get however many electors as representatives and senators you have in Congress. So, you know, that's stated, and basically that functions in the same way as a joint vote of Congress would have functioned in terms of allocating the votes between North and South. Incidentally, another thing that I should have mentioned, but didn't remember to mention everything, is the impact of the Three-Fifths Compromise on this, because the Southern states, because when it's based on the number of representatives you have, Southern states are getting a three-fifths boost for the presidency in the same way that they got the three-fifths boost for the Congress. Now, if you take away that three-fifths boost, they've done the calculations, and Jefferson would have lost the election of 1800. You know, there's different calculations, but it's between a shift of 10 and 12, and he definitely would have lost it. You know, and Pauline pointed out to me the other day that then the white people cast three-fifths of a vote, right? Once Jim Crow came in, okay, they and no blacks were voting, but they were included in the population, white Southerners cast a full vote for every black person in that state. See? And that's why Storm Thurmond opposed any change in the Electoral College. That's thanks to Pauline. And you were going to say something.
Well, I was just going to go back to this issue of why you needed this Electoral College. I mean, if you wanted separation of powers, obviously the legislative could not choose
right.
The executive. But several states had solved that problem by having their governors popularly elected. Now, why not have a popular election for the president? And then the issue, of course, Mason said, people don't have the information
right.
about other candidates. Well, that ceased to be true very quickly with the spread of newspapers and their easy distribution through the post office already after 1792. But there's another great reason. The way this institution is so incredibly connected with the institution of slavery, you mentioned the Three-Fifths Clause. Mm-hmm. It gave white minority in the South greater power than they would have if it was a popular election. Moreover, as Madison, I think, said at one point, if there was direct popular election of the president, the North would name him all the time, because the franchise is more generous. In other words, more people could vote in the North than could vote in the Southern colonies. What this system did was to let the white planter minority, which controlled the Southern states, cast the full contingent of electoral votes allocated to that state based on population plus the two for the Senate, if hardly anyone could vote. It didn't matter how many people could vote. So it was intensely and incredibly connected with the institution of slavery, giving the advantage to this small
right. minority. Now, there was a way they could have gotten out of that, though. Madison's argument about, I mean, the argument that Southerners used, actually, not just Madison, against the popular vote is you can just increase the franchise to increase your number, your influence. That could have been sidestepped by just weighting the vote the same way they eventually did for the electors. You know, you can weight it by state. And regardless of the franchise, that could have been done, you know, mathematically. It was feasible to be done. Another point, but what's happening is you have, tell me if this is sounding familiar. You have self-interest on several levels, small state, slave state, so on. And you have this ideological interest about the people are not quite prepared, we need the successive filtrations. So, you know, you ever hear of self-interest and ideology sort of mentioned before? You know, that tends to happen a few times. Another thing, though, about that, the popular election of the president, I mean, of the governor, okay? Interestingly enough, at the beginning, no state had a popular election, right? In the first state constitutions, all the early state constitutions, early I mean in basically 70, 75, 76, 70, until the last two, New York and Massachusetts, New York in 77 and Massachusetts in 80, have popular elections, right? And so that's in the vocabulary. But also in the vocabulary is the fact that, yeah, New York has a popular election, and look what they did with it. Who's the governor? This opponent of the Constitution, you know? Massachusetts have a popular election, and this is kind of in the uninformed, prejudicial thing. And look what's happening in Massachusetts. You know, that's, of course, the so-called, but improperly called Shays Rebellion. You know, so they had, there's these kind of guilt by associations. My suspicion is that it's only tried in two states. It's only tried on the governorship, and both states are sort of suspect. And then you also have to look at who's in the room. You know, who's making this decision? And that's what Pauline said, there's the Southerners, but even in the Northerners, who's making the decision? These people are not predisposed to giving a whole lot of power to popular people. So to really understand the history of it, we do have to get back to your question, that people are... When I said there's a balance, you know, I think there was a balance, but I think the balance tilted in minimal... We need popular sovereignty. It has to be somewhat based on the people, but let's just get away with as little as we can, you know, and, yeah.
To bring it up more recently, the fact that we have term limits, we should, if you trust the people, why have term limits?
Okay. You know, that's an open-ended question, but I think it's a little too open-ended for right now, and I think we should, because it is 7:30, I'd like to finish. Okay, that's good. It's a good question. Thank you very much.